Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to the Oldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to the distinguished journalist, Mary Kenny, writer, journalist, and most importantly, the writer of the Oldies Postcards from the Edge column. And Mary, am I right in saying you've been a journalist for 60 years?
Yes, it must be that, actually. Perhaps even a little bit more, as I'm 81 now, so I was about 19 or 20 when I started. So it's, yeah, so it's, I suppose it's quite a stretch, isn't it?
So that's since 64 or so. And I think you'll correct me, but Hugh Cudlip or somebody said, I pity anyone who isn't a journalist. I still think it's the most enjoyable job in the world for all the trials it's going through. Do you still find it enjoyable?
Well, I find it in some ways agonising, actually, because it's it attracts people who are sometimes quite sensitive and they get rejected quite a lot. And it's really quite difficult, you know, and certainly in the early part of your career, you do get terribly rejected. And, you know, you think you're writing this deathless prose, you know, and it's slashed and everything like that. You have to go through all these what feels like humiliations. I mean, you learn in the fullness of time that does it matter greatly. I'm in two minds about all those things. I mean, I also have a bit of an inferiority complex about never having gone to university. And I think, you know, it would be so much better to have gone to be able to go to university and be clever and academic. And I did say to my husband once...
Your husband was the distinguished writer, Richard West.
Yes, Dick died in 2015. But I did say once... You know, if only I'd gone to Trinity College Dublin, my life would have been completely different. And he said, no, it wouldn't, Mary. You're a discontented person. And you'd be discontented if you'd gone to Trinity College Dublin just the same.
So. Also, there is a thing. Nicky Haslam wrote a piece about this for the Oldie, that quite often he also didn't go to university. Very clever people like him and you and various other people. Lucinda Lambton, our Overlook Britain correspondent. Actually, there's some sort of magic that goes together with the intelligence, which isn't flattened and beaten out of someone by going to university.
Well, I suppose you become a bit of an autodidact, you know, and you're always trying to teach yourself things. But I do think that there is a polish and there is an access to learning, which is wonderful at university, you know. But but it was just the period that was in it, Harry, too, yeah. You know, that... when I was expelled from school, actually, in 1960. I mean, in Ireland, certainly very few people went on to university. You had to be one of the two cleverest people in the county, or else you had to have rich enough parents that they didn't mind you swanning around at university for as long as it took. And so it was... It just wasn't democratised. Now it's normal.
I must ask you, why were you thrown out of school at 16?
I was terribly, terribly difficult, bold, as they say, and rebellious child. And I was always disrupting everything. I now think I had ADHD. I'm actually pretty sure I did, because I had all the symptoms of being, you know, terribly fidgety and constantly... you know, constantly looking for attention and wild and disobedient and difficult and not able to concentrate on anything. And I was regarded as a corrupting force. Reverend Mother said, Mary, you're like the bad apple in the barrel. Whatever you touch, you will corrupt.
Might it not have been that you were extremely clever and that intelligence wasn't being catered for properly at school, do you think?
I suppose I'd now get a shrink. Nowadays, young people get shrinks, don't they? But I suppose, you know, in common with my generation, there was, although I suppose in England and Wales and Scotland, perhaps there was more possibilities for children who were maladjusted, I don't know. But there was this rather tough attitude. You've had your chance at education. Now you must go and earn your living. You know, you must sink or swim in a way. So you were sort of thrown into the world to get on with life, which was quite a tough kind of thing. And I'd be appalled to think of my grandchildren at 16 having to go out in the world and start earning their living. I mean, you know, we're so much more tender about children now, so much more protective, you know. And
which may not necessarily be a good thing. You've written in your latest column, The Oldie, I think it was the Mother Superior, who explained it, who said that you mustn't mind about slights when you're young. What was it she said?
That was the big thing, Mother Margaret Mary. Yes, she said, nobody likes a touchy person. Don't be touchy. If somebody says something insulting or offensive to you, you know, laugh it off. Just go on with it. Don't take it to heart, you know, because you'll make yourself miserable, and it's much better to be robust, you know, and resilient about these things.
And that's a brilliant lesson. I'd say also it's a very good lesson learnt in journalism, that thing of when you begin, you think you're going to be Ernest Hemingway meets Scott Fitzgerald, and then somebody says, this is no good, and slashes it in half. And to begin with, you're very upset. And then you get very tough, and you realise they're almost always right.
That's very true. And you do learn quickly in journalism the Jesuit idea that you learn more from your mistakes than from your successes, actually, you know. And one has to bear that in mind all one's life. You know, quite often if something has been altered or changed, it's often for the best, but not always, you know. And there's another, I suppose you do develop another thing where I think a journalist and I suppose a writer possibly must have their own tone of voice, you know. So there is that notion of a tone of voice, because the reader picks that up, you know. So if there's supposedly perhaps a sub-editor who's hostile to your tone of voice and wishes and tries to iron out all the little quirky bits, that is a disservice in a way. So sometimes you do have to stand up for that.
Yes, and in fact, a famous example of that is the brilliant Giles Corran. I think he's a terrific columnist, but he got very, very angry with a sub-editor changing the last word of a column, which did make an awful difference to the rhythm of the last sentence. At his own admission, he went so madly angry, I think he then wrote a book about anger. But he's a brilliant writer, and syntax and rhythm is all in brilliant writers like that.
Yes, that's very true. But there's another contrasting story, Harry, which really reflects very well on the sub-editor. When my old boyfriend, Bernard Levin, was beginning to develop dementia, really, or Alzheimer's, I'm not sure which it was, and his great boast was, you know, that he could write 1,000 words in one sentence and it would parse absolutely perfectly. And he was beginning to, his writing was beginning to show that his mind was impaired, actually. And there was a very kind sub-editor on the Times who was able to kind of straighten it out, his prose, but if you like, do a pastiche of his style. So he was... Bernard's voice was preserved much longer by the kindness of a sub-editor who you know, enabled him to go on much longer, really writing his much-admired column in the Times. But, of course, eventually he did have to retire.
How amazing. And, Mary, you wrote an issue ago about working for the great Edna O'Brien, who's just... there's just been a new, very good documentary about her called Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story. What were you doing for her, and what was she like?
Well, I was really her typist just for a short time. It would have been in 1965, actually, and I was in London and I was sort of trying to get into journalism. I was freelancing one way or another, and I don't know whether it was through some Irish connection that, you know, Edna said, I need a bit of typing to be done, you know, so would you do so? Of course, I was delighted, you know. And she was incredibly kind and indulgent, and I wasn't a very good secretary, so we didn't get very much done, actually. But it was a great insight, you know, into her life and times and work. She had, you know, so, I mean, obviously it was... She was a complex person. She was always falling in love, but usually with somebody very difficult.
Which she said very bravely.
Yes, she always went for, you know, somebody who was out of reach in some way. I think she had quite a long relationship with John Freeman, who was very famous at the time for presenting a program on television called...
Face to face,
wasn't it? And he interviewed people like Evelyn Waugh and Carl Jung and so on. And I think that was quite a long relationship. And I think that that's perhaps the model for The Love Object, which is a collection of her very good short stories. I actually like Edna's short stories better than her novels myself, although I think the early novels are great fun. But so she was. But Maureen Cleave, who was a journalist, a very good interviewer on the Evening Standard, I mean, she was always very surprised when she first interviewed Edna. She said she was really this quite almost ordinary looking sort of country Irish girl, you know. And the next time she interviewed her, she was this beautiful Chelsea, you know, flame haired, you know, beauty. And she did kind of develop a style in London, she of her own. And she had this gorgeous hair. And she did become a beauty. She was very aware of it. She was very, very, she was very particular about presentation and about her clothes, her makeup, and everything. And of course, she'd had quite an important formation in a way in a convent school, and I think she brought the discipline of a nun to. Both to her beauty routine and to, you know, and to her work as well.
And brilliantly eloquent in this very good film. There's a terrific clip of her on a Melvyn Bragg interview where she says men are useless except for some vague passing sexual pleasure, but she gives this brilliant delivery of a long sentence. She's a wonderful performer.
Yes, yes. She very, very eloquent indeed. I mean, I think... Edna's life has been made sort of made into a kind of epic, and she's become very symbolic, I suppose, of that generation which rebelled against Catholic Ireland. But there's a certain amount of legend, really, as well in all epics. So, you know, she was. It's always said, oh, she, of course, her books were banned in Ireland. Well, the trouble with the Irish censorship. System at the time was that it was absurdly over-democratic. It only needed two people to object to a book and it would be banned. And there's more than a suspicion that sometimes books were banned because rival authors submitted these books to the censorship. Or, I mean, there was no scandal from what I remember at all about her books in Dublin. But in County Clare, I think there was a resentment because she portrayed her parents in a very, very brutal sort of light. But she, you see, the thing about Edna is that she did believe in being very honest and writing what she really thought. And she portrayed her parents as sort of peasant, brutal peasants, you know. And, of course, the local people in County Clare thought that her parents were only trying to protect her from running off with an unsuitable man, which she did learn in the fullness of time that the man she married was horrible to her. You know? So it was
Gebre Davis, who was a brute, wasn't he?
Well, you see, it again was complicated. His nephew, Stan Gebre Davis, always said that he was terribly helpful to Edna at the beginning to help her structure her work, and because he had been a successful writer himself. But he became very controlling and abusive, and she does write in her autobiography that he was terribly jealous of her success, so it became that kind of complicated a relationship, you know, and she had a terrible divorce, really, as she writes about. Her autobiography, Country Girl, is also a very good, very interesting insight into her life. She had this lovely style of dressing. She went to a designer in Soho called Thea Porter, who had sort of upmarket hippie clothes, you know, beautiful hippie clothes. And I think Thea Porter had connections with the Middle East and the Lebanon and so on. So it was all, and maybe I think there were connections with spies as well. And she was always wafting around in these beautiful.
I saw her in later life. I mean, late into her 80s, she looked fantastic.
Yeah.
And Maris, you then came over here from Dublin and you were working on London's Diary at the age of 21, is that right?
Well, the story really is that I first went to Paris when I was 18. And I don't know whether it was, you'll know Harry better than me, but whether it was Marx or Napoleon who said, if you want the key to anyone's life, ask what they were doing at 20.
And what were you doing at 20?
And at 20, I was an au pair girl in France. You know, I was first in a suburb. I was first in a suburb of Paris, and then I was in the 17th arrondissement, where I became a companion to an eccentric old lady, and then I was in a teaching in a convent in the Basse-Pyrénées. But so that period of my life, and of course, when you're old, as all other oldies know, all these things come back to you in a flash. You know, all these memories come back, kind of unbidden almost. And that, in a way, was the most formative period of my life, being 20 in France.
Because it wasn't anything to do with journalism, but because it was so intimidating, or why?
Well, I think if it was Karl Marx, it was. He actually said it didn't matter what the regime was. It was because you were 20. That was. I think somebody said to him, how could someone like being 20 when they were in Brussels in a repressive regime? And Marx said, but because you're 20, that's the thing. Yeah. No, it was very exciting. And I suppose 1960, that would have been, what was 1960, from 1962 to 64. This really was the beginning of a sort of period of street, one might say, street revolutions and so on.
Long before 68.
You know, it was long. Yeah. It was bubbling away because, of course, Algeria was, and of course, you know, I suppose I'd come from Ireland, which was very old-fashioned, you know, really in the 50s and 60s, and I was sort of exposed to this French, extraordinary French bubbling up of you know, manifestation and all kinds of politics all over. So it had a huge impression on me. It made a huge impression on me, you know. And I suppose then, you know, then I came to London, and London was beginning to sort of be very stirring.
And all these things, actually, I would say they're more powerful and probably more interesting in forming someone than 3 years at university. You're learning to be a grown-up that much earlier.
I suppose that's true, Harry, and life was quite hard as an au pair. You want to work for a French woman to know what hard work is like, you know. And again, you know, the flashbacks come. I worked very hard for this French woman who had 7 children, and she used to follow me around with a vacuum cleaner saying, Mademoiselle, il faut tout déplacer, il faut tout déplacer, you must move everything. You know, and when I'm hoovering now at home, I hear this voice in my head, you know, il faut tout déplacer. You know, it's silly, but it's just an example of the things that influence you. And I suppose people do say, you know, I mean, I suppose younger people do say it was must be exciting to have come of age in the 60s, you know. And I suppose, you know, quite a lot of social historians do think that the 60s became a crucial period of social change.
And you were a very avant-garde figure. You were a founding member of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, which was extremely well known at the time. I know you don't think people got it right. You were on the famous wrongly called condom train.
No, it was a condom train. Yes. And because I worked in Dublin, I worked in London first, you know, and then I went back to Dublin to be woman's editor of a newspaper in Dublin. So yes, so I was involved in the Irish Women's Liberation Movement. But even in the mid 60s in London, you know, it was also a period of protest, you know, big period of protest. And I mean, I remember going with Anna Wintour to a anti-Vietnam War rally, you know. Well, I wasn't with Anna, but her father, Charles Wintour, who was editor of the Evening Standard, said, do keep an eye on her, will you? You know, I seem to be given that job. I think she was going out with Tariq Ali at the time, and I think she spent most of the morning, according to her father, deciding what should one wear to that, you know, perhaps it should be a Viet Cong miniskirt or something. I mean, it was all
not the icy stare and the dark glasses then.
No. And I mean, it's interesting that I see that she's become more politically engaged now, but I remember Charles saying to me, I'm almost sure Anna knows there are two political parties in America, you know, that she was so she was so obsessed with fashion that she didn't see much outside that. But of course, she's right to be obsessed by fashion if she wants to be a fashion editor.
It stood her in good stead, yeah.
It stood her in very good stead. So those kind of protests in London were going on from 65, 66, 67 was 68. And the
Vietnam and Grosvenor Square.
In Grosvenor Square and LSE and sit-ins and so on. And, I mean, I suppose the Vietnam War and civil rights movement were important, but I think there was a side to it which we just thought was great fun, you know. And I think probably even today, do you think this is true, that, you know, the kids who are going out with, I mean, they probably have sympathy for Palestine and the environment and everything, but, you know, part of it is fun, don't you think?
Yeah, and I'm sure, to be literally the solidarity with your friends and be doing something...
Yes.
More serious than going to a nightclub.
Yes. And annoying your family as well, or you're annoying,
very
you know.
Powerful motive,
great French phrase, épater les bourgeois, la bourgeoisie, you know. To upset the bourgeoisie is terribly important, you know. Although, mind you, sometimes it's the bourgeoisie that's doing the upsetting.
Mary, tell me, to go back a bit, you had a very old father, born in the 1870s, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yes.
That must have had an effect on your character, do you think? What effect did it have?
Well, I suppose the effect of was that he died when I was quite young, you know. But my parents were 100 years married, 100 this year. They were married in 1925. And I always think that's rather nice, in a way, to have that sense of continuity, you know, looking back and so on. And what I think, I mean, obviously, if you have a very old father, then, you know, he's more likely to die before you grow up. But nevertheless, I have always felt this sort of transmitted feeling of looking back over the whole of the 20th century and into the late Victorian period, because there's something that's transmitted from your parents, isn't there? Because they, you know, your mother and your aunts and uncles talk about these stories.
Yes,
and
you must have been thinking about what your dad was doing in 1900, what he was doing.
Well, he was yes. Well, he was in South America, actually, so he had a long period in South America. Which
what did he do for a living?
Well, he was going to be a Jesuit priest, and you have to be 7 years in the seminary to be a Jesuit priest, but he was in a beautiful seminary in Beirut, in the Lebanon, a rather beautiful place, apparently, at the end of the 19th century, and very harmonious. You know, Christians, Jews, Muslims lived very happily together, apparently, in the Lebanon, you know, yes, absolutely. But he decided not to become a priest, so he went to Salamanca University and qualified in Romance languages, and he taught in Latin America, in Santiago and Chile. But there's a whole period of his life we knew nothing, we never knew anything about, really, you know, except that he rode horses like gauchos. But it's interesting, because I suppose if I was younger, I might research that period of his life. But I think it's too late now, and I also, maybe I don't want to know, really, you know. Maybe there are hidden aspects of his life that he didn't want. You know, I think that's an interesting question, you know, you see in these Who Do You Think You Are programs, where people are examining their family lives. And, of course, it's very informative and it's wonderful that it's available, but sometimes you don't always want to pursue the private life.
There's some terrible shock in there. But Mary, you then spent most of your life over in London. What effect do you think your Irishness has had on your journalism and writing? I think I spent a lot of time in Ireland, Northern Ireland, and it produces a sort of sideways look at the world, but also an extra element to writers as well.
Yeah, and until last year, Harry, I always kept a residence in Ireland as well, you know, and I have a sort of little perch still. And I suppose, you know, what people always say to writers, write about what you know, or discover more about what you know. So I suppose it's provided for, it's the whole thing of being back and forth between Ireland and England. And also France, of course, is always there in the background.
And you live now in Deal, which is only a pop, skip and jump.
Yes,
France,
yes, yeah. That's right. Although post-Brexit, it's even harder to get to France. But but anyway, I think it's, you know, your roots as a writer, you know, the history of your society and culture is a very, it can be very enriching to explore and so on. And Ireland is particularly interesting to me because it's gone through all these seismic changes. I mean, when I was a youngster, you know, it was a very poor country, of course. I mean, we were sort of bourgeois, so we weren't actually hungry or deprived particularly. But, I mean, one knew there was poverty, and even when I was quite young, I think there were little boys on the streets of Dublin selling newspapers barefoot, actually.
Yeah, you see photos then. From
yes,
India.
And so it was poor, and there was huge emigration, and farms were terribly small and so on. And now it's a terribly rich country, you know. It's got, I don't know, a huge surplus of in the treasury, you know.
Yeah, much higher GDP per head than here, yeah.
Yes. I mean, I know some of that is slightly, you know, because of the big corporations, you know, have invested there. But it has become a very, and it's completely transformed, completely different. And these changes are very interesting. I mean, they are good change, like all change is good in some ways and has a downside in other ways, you know.
But there remains that, and it's easy to be cliched about Ireland, but there does remain a kind of a lyricism to the way people speak, don't you think? And a unusual way of looking at things and describing things.
Well, yes, I think there is the Blarney, you know, in a way. I remember when I interviewed Enoch Powell, and, you know, he'd been the MP for South Down, where, of course, as I may have mentioned, I think, in the Oldie at one point, he did address the farmers of South Down in classical Greek. You know,
how did that go down?
Well, they were terribly flattered. Of course, they were delighted with themselves. You know that he paid them the tribute of doing that. You know, but I did say to him, you know, how did you feel about the Protestants who were the Unionists and the Catholics who were the Nationalists? How did you see them in different ways? And he simply said, well, the Catholics have the Blarney. The Protestants don't. And I mean, that's a little bit of a stereotype, actually, because you meet Protestant Ulstermen who are very loquacious.
Yes,
you know.
I can be. In fact, Mary Killen, another columnist in the Oldie, Protestant from Larne, has an extremely amusing.
Oh, yes. Absolute turn of phrase. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not true, but it is sometimes true, you know. And that the Protestants had this very direct Scottish way of speaking, you know. And, of course, the Irish way of talking and telling stories. The Irish have no interest whatsoever, as far as I can see, in intellectual ideas. None whatsoever. What the Irish like are stories. They'll always listen to a story. It's much more difficult in Ireland, and I've written in Ireland for quite a long time as well, to have these. You know, you'd never get a Roger Scruton in Ireland, you know, where you have somebody interested in political and intellectual ideas. Because
you get brilliant academics like Professor Roy Foster, don't you?
Yes, but he's a historian, you know, and he's mostly published in England, after all, isn't he? You know, Roy is. It's the story. It's the telling the stories, you know, that is very central to Irish culture. But the other thing is, David McWilliams is a very brilliant Irish economist who knows an awful lot about money and has always been very prophetic about how the economy is going and everything. He said a little while ago, the Irish are a rich people who still think they're a poor people, and they still have the mentality. And I think that is true, that the Irish literary voice, for example, is still very much misery, the misery stories. Oh, how miserable we were.
The Angela's Ashes approach.
Yeah, that's all been, you know, you've got people like Emer McBride today and other, a terrific flowering of young novelists, but it's very frequently a misery story, you know. And
harder to, you'd thought, as you're saying, when Apple are pouring billions into the Irish economy.
Whereas you would think now that they're very rich, you would come up with a kind of bright, you know, prosperous, optimistic, the way the Americans are, you know, always sort of so optimistic about everything. Isn't it great we're prosperous? But that doesn't really suit the Irish character, I think.
And how things change. You wrote a brilliant book, Crown Shamrock, Love and Hate Between Ireland and the British Monarchy in 2009. Not long after that, Elizabeth II went over to Ireland. And wouldn't you say relations have improved enormously?
Well, yes, and it was terribly rewarding writing that book because I was very fortunate to be allowed into the Windsor archives. You know, it was marvellous to read the diaries of Queen Victoria. You know, Edward the VII didn't write all that much. He wasn't the same cast of mind, really, although he was very popular in Ireland because he was greeted with banners like "Welcome to the King, who is friend of our Pope," you know, because Edward the VII was very he was very at home in continental Europe, you know.
He was keen on the Entente Cordiale.
He was always on these spas and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, and so he was also interested in, he would attend mass with Austrian aristocrats and things like that. He hadn't got a sort of prejudice against Catholics, which was still a little bit common at the time, but with people like Lord Salisbury, you know. He did have apparently very amicable discussions with the Pope, or I think would have been Leo the 13th. So he was popular in Ireland. And then George the 5th, who wrote a very, very, very touching diary, actually. Very much the diary of an ordinary man in a way, almost pooterish, but really sincere, you know, and he wrote it very, very frequently, you know, and he wrote very well about Ireland, where he was so keen to be fair to everyone. It's my job to be fair and to hold the ring, you know, and not to be partisan, although his heart was really with the Union, obviously. He didn't want Ireland to break away, but he still felt the Home Rulers are, you know, they are elected and I must do my best, you know, and he really did try so hard. In fact, he was so focused on Ireland that he didn't really notice the First World War breaking out. And in his diary in June, 1914, you know, such a pity about, you know, poor Franz Ferdinand, you know, getting assassinated. But now back to Ireland, you know, sort of he didn't even notice that it was so significant.
But relations, would you say, have got better? I mean, astonishingly, the troubles, I know it's still not perfect, but amazingly, I never thought as a child they'd ever come to an end. They've largely come to an end. And that anti-Englishness, I don't suffer it when I go to Ireland. It's very little of it left, would you say?
Well, it was never personal, Harry. You know, it was always, there was always the little bit of fondness for the Englishman as a person, you know, rather. But deep down, there's still a little bit of Anglophobia there, you know. You still come across it because you come across it like with the rise of something like NECAP. A group from Northern Ireland who are agitating for Palestine and so on. But they've got a lot of F the Brits and all this sort of thing. And,
Wearing balaclavas. And wearing balaclavas.
And, you know, they're getting applauded everywhere, including by young Brits as well, you know. So maybe it's all an act, I don't know. But I think there would still be a little bit, because there'd be quite serious discussion about whether Ireland should join NATO, you know, because the Europeans are getting together to form common defences and so on, and Ireland's opposite say we're not going to join NATO because NATO is a British imperial, blah blah blah. They go off on that kind of a thing. So there's a little bit of that hereditary thing still. I think it's just chippiness myself, actually, but there was always the affection. I mean, for somebody like Lord Longford, for example, you know, who I know you're related to, you know,
your great uncle,
and his brother Edward before him, who supported the Gate Theatre, and there's always tremendous devotion to Lord Longford. Mind you, the Longfords were tactful enough to fly the tricolour from the Tollinally Castle quite soon after the Irish state was established.
Edward Longford learned Irish and became a senator. I mean,
that's right, of course. Yeah.
Mary, forgive me, but I must refer to your drinking days, and if you're happy to talk about the Ugandan discussions, can you say what that
Well, this will be an opportunity for me to practice humility, as Lord Longford would have said. Well, I suppose when I was a young woman, I was very wild and very drunk quite a lot of the time, and often, you know, and I was caught in an indiscretion with a terribly, terribly nice African guy. And Private Eye didn't miss the opportunity to practice misogyny and racism by turning this into a sort of mockery of, you know, and they called it talking about Uganda and so on, and it was a snog, so what?
Yeah. Yeah, well, also, the Mother Superior's words must have rolled through your head of when you're on the wrong end of those kind of attacks, which I have been, got to pretend not to mind, but often one does mind.
That's very true, and what annoys me, actually, is that it was used in, the expression was used in a very famous television screen adaptation by Phoebe
Waller-Bridge.
Yes, her first very what was her
Fleabag.
First Fleabag, and it came into that.
Did it? Right.
Yes, and I thought they're making millions out of this, absolutely millions. And here am I sitting here worrying about my pension. What about giving me a little bit of copyright money for this? You know, so it's the money I care about.
Yes, the old Dr. Johnson line: "Only a fool doesn't work for money."
Well, not entirely. I mean, I suppose I won't say it's not true, because I think with something like the oldie, there's a tremendous esprit, I think, the core in the oldie, and a tremendous sense of the readers, you know, and the feeling of the readers. And I think that's a terribly important thing, you know, in a magazine, that you have the feeling of connecting with readers.
Yes, and you feel a sort of, I don't know what you call it, a kind of shared irony, slight world weariness, yes, and unshockability.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, I think you've created a very good tone there, actually. The great Irish, wonderful, not he wasn't, he was a fake Irishman, but he was a wonderful person, Micheál MacLiamore, the actor. He had a one-man show called I Must Be Talking to My Friends, you know, and it was just a omnium gatherum of, you know, his life and everything like that. And I often think that is a kind of byword of what a column should be. I must have this feeling of connection with soulmates, as it were. You know, maybe I'm overstating it,
but I think you should feel
that.
Papers have gone downhill, I think, when they try to be everything to everybody, and so they remove any peculiarities or anything that's a bit shocking or
yes,
a bit funny. Those great columnists we're talking about, like Giles Curran or Jeremy Clarkson,
yes,
actually, they're very idiosyncratic.
Yes.
But people, some people hate them, but people who like them get it. The more unusual, the more individual, and the more honest they are, the more they appreciate it. The moment you kind of slightly dumb it down but try to appeal to everyone, then paradoxically no one reads it.
Yes, and I think with those columnists who are on the wavelength of the readers, there's a sense of trust. The reader trusts, you know, what they're going to say. And it's quite fascinating, the whole art of the column, really, in a way, because the way in which, of course, I greatly admired Peregrine Worsthorn back in the day, because he often had a paradoxical kind of way of looking at things, you know. But he was both reliable and surprising, which is a very difficult kind of art, you know, to get those two notes together, as it were.
Yeah, that's a very good combination. I hadn't heard that. I was going to ask you, in fact, because you've been very kind, appeared on quite a few oldie writing courses, and I interviewed you and Ian Wilson a few years ago about journalism. His tip for young journalists was a brilliant one: don't go on holiday in August, because that's when,
yes,
all the senior people are away. That might get your break. Have you got any particular tips, not just for young journalists, for any journalists, or how to write a good column?
It's so very difficult. I mean, I suppose the first thing I think is very, very important is to read. And you must read your own paper above all. Read very closely the paper or a magazine you hope to write for. That's absolutely crucial, you know, to get the feeling. And you must read very, very widely and make lots and lots of notes and you know, develop ideas all the time. That's the only thing. But it is, and of course, it's very good if you can develop like a speciality where you can be the go-to person for, well, he knows all about the railways, you know, and trains and everything like that. So
there must be, every journalist has got an article they've written dozens of times. The one I've written dozens of times is why you should learn Latin. What's the column you've most, or piece you've most been asked to write?
Gosh, I think the trouble is, Harry, is that ideas do come back. They do come back again because there's a new spin, you know, on the, there's a new angle, something else. The story has developed in some way, you know, that. So I suppose, I mean, I did write in the Irish media quite a bit about the royal family, about the British monarchy quite a bit, you know. And of course, it's absolutely developing story because there's a new, you know, even though there's also some things are reiterated, but there's a new.
And also everyone knows the cast.
The cast,
very helpful.
Yes.
You have to say Prince Harry, who was the second son of the king.
Yes, yes.
Already set up.
Yes.
It?
I mean, one of the, you mentioned, you know, whether the Irish were now sort of in a relaxed and friendly relationship, and indeed the relations between Dublin and London are very, very good on a policy level and so on. But I mean, the Irish media will sometimes distinguish themselves by saying Prince Harry, the British prince, you know, just to ensure you're not thinking of the Norwegian prince, you know, or the Saudi prince or something, you know. So they you know, they like to take little stand like that, you know, that's a little bit, you know, Republican kind of thing, you know. I mean, I was fascinated how, you know, President Macron has said recently and often said before, Queen Elizabeth wasn't just Queen Elizabeth of Britain, she was the Queen, you know, which I think...
It was a very good line.
Yes, very yes. good line, yeah.
And Mary, we haven't got time to cover your extraordinary career, but you've also wrote a play, Allegiance, in which Mel Smith played Winston Churchill and Michael Fassbender played Michael Collins, and you wrote a terrific biography of William Joyce, a.k.a. Lord Haw-Haw, Germany Calling. These are all intriguing people. Do you form, but they're all quite unusual, do you form different obsessions with people? How does the idea for a book particularly or a play about somebody come to your mind?
Well, actually, with Michael Collins and Winston Churchill, my husband, Richard, he actually read a terrific book called an early biography of Churchill, in which he said, you know, how Churchill and Collins in 1921, they sat up all night drinking, you know, together, boozing, just before the Free State was introduced. And I thought that is a terrific, you know, a situation for a play, really. And they did have that in common, actually.
And they got on.
They did more or less get on, yes, they did get on. I mean, they wanted different things and everything like that. But Churchill had this... he had this kind of affection for the warrior, you know. He liked the idea of the warrior, and he did say at one point to Michael Collins, you know, Michael Collins said to him, you know, you put £10,000 on my head, Mr. Churchill, and Winston said, Mr. Collins, when the Boers captured me, they put but £25 on my head. So, you know, you were more valuable than I was as that. But, and of course, Mick said, well, you have to take inflation into account, you know. So there was that bit of banter. And Churchill did, of course, support Collins in setting up the Free State then. But it still, you know, was... and Churchill sent very, very nice condolences when Collins was shot. So, I mean, it was just an interesting situation for a play. And, of course... But what was became rather notorious about was that Mel Smith wanted to smoke a cigar on stage in Churchillian mode, and of course that nearly closed down the whole of the Edinburgh Festival because you're not allowed to smoke a cigar on stage.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lord Haw-Haw, I love your book about him, he came across as a kind of fairly pathetic figure. It's amazing he became so prominent.
Well, he was a terrible man, obviously, but he was also quite a brilliant broadcaster, actually. He really did introduce innovation into broadcasting because he was a talker, you know. And so he was a very, very strange person. But I met his, you know, his daughter was a terribly nice woman, Heather, and she really...
Still alive now.
Well, she died a couple of years ago, and she was a school teacher and terribly good and desperately tried to make amends, you know, especially to the Jewish community. He was a frightful anti-Semite. You know, and she tried so hard because although she hated his politics and what he said, she loved him as a father. Oh, you know, yes. It was really so a sad situation in a way, you know. So, yes, and I do think, you know, one should always write more books. You know, even though the world is full of books, I do feel that, you know, journalists should also write books because books are always on deposit. Even if they don't sell, you know, they're on deposit somewhere. The London Library will have them, the British Library will have them, you know.
And also, even if people don't read them, they know you've written them, so you have another string to your bow. Now, if he does crop up in the news next time, Lord Haw Haw's in the news, they'll say, oh, let's get Mary Kenny to write.
Well, you also learn so much in writing a book. Yeah, I mean, it is really such a learning experience. And I suppose with journalism, even though, you know, we do work hard and do our best and everything like that, you know, it is an ephemeral trade after all. And I suppose looking back, I wrote something for about 60 years in journalism for the Irish Times, although I usually write for the Irish Independent, but in this case, and I was looking back and thinking... Well, really, my theme was how much more bohemian life was for journalists in the early 60s. It was terribly easy go. I mean, it was mad in many ways and very, very heavy. There was a lot of heavy drinking, but there was a life, a sense of bohemianism, and you could sort of get into it, and it was not so formalised, as it were, and certainly you didn't have to be a graduate. In fact, I had an office job for a while at The Guardian, where I was told by the night editor, we don't want varsity men here, you know, we don't want their stuck up.
And actually often, the supposed very clever ones, they don't have that, whatever you want to call it, that knack for journalism. It doesn't seem to be necessarily related to university education at all. It's a thing you can either do or you can't. I'm not saying it's particularly... magical, and I like calling it a trade rather than a profession, but it's amazing how often very clever people, often academics, just can't do it.
Yes, well, also I suppose they are used to sort of taking much longer in research or something, because I suppose one of the skills of the journalist, you know, dear Keith Waterhouse used to say a journalist should be able to turn his hand to any subject, you know. I mean, if somebody comes and asks you for a libretto for an opera, the correct answer is, will next Tuesday do?
Or if I once asked Colin Lucas, the Master of Balliol, to write something about Oxford, and he said, yes, I'd love to, nice man. He said, I can get it to you in 5 months. And I said, well, actually, we actually need it by 5 o'clock this afternoon. Yeah. And he couldn't, he just wasn't capable of doing it.
Yes, that's right. So yes, that is a considerable difference. But I still think, I mean, I still have a terrific kind of awe for a true egghead, you know, for the true intellectuals and, you know, clever clogs.
Well, I think you're vastly superior to all of them. And I'd like to say thanks so much to Mary Kenny for appearing on Radio Oldie. Thanks so much.
It's an honour.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.